Today is Monday, April 22nd, 2013, and this is episode 15 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. The first thing I'm going to cover tonight is a recent spate of Twitter account takeovers. So in the recent week, 60 Minutes, 48 Hours, and NPR all had their Twitter accounts compromised by different groups. All of these organizations are pretty well respected and would normally be considered a reputable site and would normally be accessible to employees. But this really shows, in my view, how weak this chain really is. So we are relying on these as authoritative sources, and you know, they're above board, and they are going to post official links and generally be a safe source of content. But the problem is, as a defender, we don't have control over those accounts. And so if they make a misstep, let's say an NPR person gets some malware on their laptop and that exposes the Twitter account credentials, or they use a really weak password, or some other mechanism that allows an attacker to have access to one of those accounts, it becomes pretty easy to see how that type of scenario can direct a large number of people, particularly maybe of a particular political stripe or economic stripe or what have you, and direct them to a malware exploit site. So similar to what we saw with the CFR watering hole type attack, you know, this is another play on that. Fortunately, I don't think we actually saw that. It was more or less shenanigans being played with these Twitter accounts, you know, basically posting kind of ridiculous stories about the U.S. sponsoring terrorism and you know, different things like that. But it could just have easily been an attacker linking to a black hole site which installs paper install malware. So yet another example of why it is important to apply some kind of control, particularly for employees who have sensitive roles or sensitive access, contain sensitive data on their laptops, that sort of thing. It is important to put some fences up to keep people from stumbling across things like this accidentally. The next story is really a two-in-one. Both Microsoft and Malwarebytes released bad patches this past week. Microsoft released a Windows update which conflicted with Kaspersky antivirus and a Brazilian piece of banking software. And the combination of those created a blue screen. So the patch from Microsoft was recalled. In the case of Malwarebytes, apparently Malwarebytes started inadvertently detecting pieces of the Windows operating system itself as malicious and started deleting it, and of course that is never a good thing. So both of those, I believe, have been fixed. New updates are out, and hopefully none of you guys were impacted by those. It really shows the need to somehow find a balance between the requirement for getting patches out quickly and the diligence that we have to do to actually test things out to make sure they're not going to eat our computers for breakfast. All right, the next story is one of a new Java update, or as it's become commonly known, a new version of the Ask toolbar with some Java security updates. So this is Java 7 update 21 and Java 6 update 43. The Java 7 update 21 has 42 security fixes, 39 of which Oracle claims are remotely exploitable without authentication. Also interesting to note is, again, that they did release a new version of Java 6. And actually, Java 6 has already gone end of support. So I think this is the second time since it's been end of support that Oracle has released a Java patch. So interesting stuff there. So sticking with the Oracle and Java theme, Mark Reinhold from Oracle has released a blog post that indicates Java 8, which was due out in the fall of 2013, has slipped into 2014 because what he indicates on his blog post is a new focus on security. And apparently the combination of the very high number of bugs they're having to work through, plus apparently implementing some relatively onerous new code review processes to try to make sure they're not creating new bugs, is necessarily moving out the deployment of their new Java 8. So, you know, I think this is actually hopefully perceived as encouraging and maybe viewed as Oracle trying to take this security problem seriously. Because, you know, I think they are, I believe this is the fourth or fifth update since the beginning of the year. Clearly, Oracle as a company is applying a lot of resources to this problem. The challenge is there's a really deep hole that they've got to get themselves out of. But I will say I definitely recommend, and I can't imagine ever not recommending, that Java not be installed on your workstation or your enterprise workstations, and somehow you find a way to pen it in to a particular environment with very limited access to specific resources. It's just too damn risky. All right, the next story comes from Brian Krebs' blog, as a lot of my stories do, about a botnet being created using WordPress installations. And rather than attacking vulnerable themes or vulnerable plugins or some exploit in WordPress itself, this time they're actually going after weak passwords. So it appears that the attacker, whoever they are, has set up a botnet of compromised PCs. Maybe it's a for-hire botnet, what have you, don't really know. But they are attacking WordPress installations, and they're using, you know, the default admin username and, you know, some of the top common passwords to try to log in. Once they log in, they upload a PHP script and it's off to the races for them. At the time the article was written, which has actually been about a week ago now, there were estimated to be about 90,000 compromised systems as part of this botnet of compromised WordPress hosts. And as far as I understand it, that's actually 90,000 unique IPs. So conceivably, you know, there's more actual WordPress installations because of shared hosting arrangements. There doesn't appear to be a real clear understanding of what the actual intention of this is, but I think theory is that this is going to be used in a similar way to the It's Okay, No Problem, Bro botnet we saw last year, which did some real high bandwidth DDoS attacks against financial institutions. And again, you know, when you go after these WordPress installations, they tend to be on servers and data centers with real high capacity links. They're optimized for outbound bandwidth. So you can kind of see how if you have 90,000 systems, you could pretty quickly rack up some very substantial bandwidth for denial of service attack. It could also be a precursor to some really widespread black hole type attacks or watering hole type attacks. We will just have to see. As far as what to do about it, you know, WordPress is a very common tool and it's fairly robust. It has had problems over the ages, but you know, it's, knock on wood, been doing fairly well. But one weakness is the default username being admin and human nature forcing people to pick weak passwords. So one of the key recommendations is to use a username other than admin, and obviously use a strong password, preferably one generated using that version of LastPass or KeePass or 1Pass on your system, because I know you have that, right? Now, it's interesting, my defensivesecurity.org site does run WordPress, and I have a couple of plugins which help me mitigate some of the problems of this. And over the past week, I've seen about 17,000 attempts. And interestingly, and somewhat in a departure from the story here, I do see a fair amount of intelligence in what I would call a targeted type of attack against my particular site. So they seem to be using usernames and passwords which relate to the theme of the website. So, you know, security-related usernames and security-related passwords. Anyway, it just tells me that whoever is running the attack against my particular site is probably not using the database of the 1,000 most common passwords. I mean, I do see those, but I think there's something else at play. And also interesting, I see in rapid succession 4 or 5 different IP addresses trying the same pretty obscure username and password, which is a very clear indication of a botnet activity, basically trying coordinated password attempts. My guess is they have some built-in mechanism to try to work around the problem of some IP addresses getting blacklisted. But I'll tell you, they're not doing a terribly good job of it. And just so we're clear, I am by no means claiming my site is hacker-proof in the least. I've been doing this for a long time. I know where there's a will, there's a way. Please don't hack me. Okay, moving on. Linode, who's a very popular cloud Linux server provider, was breached. And this is actually fairly weird in the sense that the attackers got in through a Cold Fusion vulnerability, which was patched back in early April. So it's not entirely clear to me if the patch was out at the time they were attacked, or maybe the patch came as a result of this hack. That timing is still not very clear to me. But what is interesting is that the attackers apparently did it to go after a few of Linode's customers. So then, rather than actually attacking the images, server images of the specific entities they were targeting, of which Nmap and a few others were included, they actually went after their hosting provider and went in through the more or less the management interface. And apparently along the way, they gathered some encrypted credit card data, which, while was great that it was encrypted, was not so good that the encryption keys were actually in the directory with the encrypted data. That's not so good. They have obtained cryptographic hashes of usernames and passwords, which apparently were salted, but still not so great as we've seen. Possibly one of the more interesting aspects of this is linked in the Register article about this is a link to a IRC chat history where the attacker keeps popping into the Linode IRC channel and is talking to the attendees in that channel about what's going on, and he proceeds to continuously get kicked, apparently by Linode, as he's talking about what he's done. Now, I can kind of understand Linode's perspective. It would certainly have been much better if the attacker had gone straight to them, but clearly, you know, that wasn't their objective. This was not a benevolent security researcher. This was somebody looking to do something bad and basically wanted to go and give a heads up to the unwitting victims of Linode's apparent security problems. And as he was having that conversation in the IRC channel, he kept getting kicked. So one of those situations where, you know, you probably don't want to react that way. I understand there's a desire to try to keep things contained, but, you know, go and Google the Streisand effect. It's a real thing, and it doesn't work in your favor usually. All right, the next story comes from Dark Reading, and it's a bunch of hoopla about a Trojan that Microsoft discovered which erases evidence of its existence. And apparently, as this piece of malware drops itself onto a system, it goes back and erases its footprints, right? So it'll erase the dropper, and it'll erase, you know, the different components that aren't needed for the ultimate payload to execute. And that makes it much more challenging to actually figure out how that malware got to be on the system. So having done a few responses to somewhat significant malware events, I can tell you it's a little surprising to me that this is kind of a thing. And by that, I mean I've actually seen this happen before. So, you know, I think it is interesting that this tactic is out there. I don't think it's new. Now, maybe this is meant to indicate that it's becoming more contemporary, and therefore the whole anti-forensics thing we've been seeing with malware looking for mouse activity, that sort of thing, and recognizing virtual environments to not run and therefore not be analyzed. You know, maybe that's all part of the same theme that the anti-forensics movement is maturing, and that I can definitely agree with. And the next story comes from Naked Security from Sophos, and this is yet another example of the worst part of humanity taking advantage of a really tragic situation like we saw in Boston and also down in West Texas. In both cases, we saw a number of different malware campaigns happening, and most of them were going out by email. They would contain a link which was basically an IP address and then some moniker that made you think it was related to the incident. So maybe boston.html or west.html. Anyway, that page took you, or that link took you to a page that had an image that looked like it was about to play a video. You click on the image and it downloads kind of the same crafty looking file name, which is, you know, a .avi ...exe. You click that and now you have some brand new malware. Certainly, you know, this is something that is really unfortunate, and in line with my theme that we need to be careful and somehow contain what people access, and, you know, whether that's by limiting their internet access or by using a tool like whitelisting, application whitelisting. But again, no technology there is perfect, and I think this is a really good opportunity to look at something new to include in your security awareness training. You know, this is this is something that is very real. It happens almost every time there's a disaster, and we can probably expect it to continue. It's happening by email, it's happening in Twitter, it's happening in Facebook. People are being bombarded with this stuff. Sometimes it comes from a friend. It looks like it's coming from your parents or your spouse or your kids or your cube mate, you know, but it's not really. And therefore, you get tricked into clicking on the link, and now you're compromised, and you're probably also propagating it to your friends. So as painful as it is to me, you know, if somebody's desperately curious to see a video of something, they need to go and look up some authoritative source. And, of course, hope that that authoritative source hasn't been previously compromised and acting as a watering hole. But I would say the probability of being impacted by visiting CNN.com is far less than clicking on one of these links, which is probably pretty close to 100%. The next story comes from CNET, who is covering Symantec's latest Internet Security Threat Report for 2013. And they have some interesting statistics about spam and malicious email. Their statistics say that in 2012, 69% of all email was spam, or traditional spam, and that is actually down from 75% in 2011. And that still includes 30 billion spam emails per day being sent. Also, they noted that emails selling sex or dating products and services are 55% of all spam. And in 2011, pharmaceutical spam had the top spot. So interesting reversal there. Probably the most interesting part, though, is their claim that in 2012, there was a 42% rise in the number of targeted attacks. I don't think there's an objective definition for what constitutes a targeted attack, but I can assume it's in some way tailored to the recipient. So it is apparently coming from a supervisor, written in a way that appears to relate to that person's business and that sort of thing. All right, next story is about Microsoft's Security Intelligence Report for the second half of 2012. I always really like reading these reports, as you probably have picked up if you listen to this show at all. But this year, I'm looking at some of the figures and graphs in their report, and I'm kind of cocking my head like a confused puppy, and I don't quite understand how they are parsing and mixing their data here. So basically, they seem to me to be including dissimilar things alongside each other. So, you know, they're comparing the number of pieces of malware that were delivered via documents with malware in the form of shellcode, heap spray, that sort of thing. And to me, it doesn't seem like the right way to cut this up. So I'm having some trouble. And I guess the other thing that bothers me some is that they lump in what they call potentially unwanted software. So things like key generation programs to unlock illegally Microsoft applications, which technically aren't malware. However, they're actually including that into their roll-up numbers and whatnot. But if you can get past some of those things, there are some interesting figures, like that Windows XP is a couple times more likely to be impacted per capita with malware events than Windows 7, and far more, obviously, as you would expect, than Windows 8, because Windows 8 is new and is yet to be really fully targeted by attackers. I'm sure it will get up there sooner or later. So, you know, I guess going back to my earlier point, I'm looking at a graph now which shows the relative number of cases of detecting the Win32 key gen, which again is a generator for illegal keys for Microsoft software, against the number of times that black hole was detected, for instance. And to me, that's not a particularly useful thing. I can understand from Microsoft's perspective, it would be very useful, but from a commercial perspective, it just doesn't do a lot for me. So I don't know what your thoughts are. But to net it all out, they're saying that the real top threats, again, if you exclude the keygen and some of the other potentially unwanted software, are malicious iframes, black hole, and Configure. I don't think those should really come as a surprise to anybody. I see new versions of Configure coming out almost daily. So, you know, that's in line with what my expectations were. And, you know, despite my earlier criticisms of the report, I still think it's very interesting, and I would encourage you to go and read it. I've got the link in the show notes to the PDF. And, you know, I'll also give Microsoft kudos, because I do think this kind of research is beneficial to us, even if some of it is not maybe directly usable to us. You know, I can imagine there are some benefits for Microsoft to portray the prevalence of things like key generation programs. But from a security perspective, it's kind of tangential. All right, sticking with Microsoft for a minute, Microsoft also released the Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit, which is probably the worst name for one of the coolest tools. Version 4 beta has just been released, and it has some very new features, which I think hopefully will be very beneficial for us who are trying to defend our networks. It improves some SSL certificate handling and enforcement. It addresses some previously known bypasses, and I think some of those were discovered in the Pwn2Own contest at CANSEC West. And it also resolves a lot of the compatibility issues with the earlier versions of EMET. Oh, and also, probably one of the more interesting things is it enables what it calls audit mode. So you can essentially put it into a mode to see what it would have done. So this might allow you to see what's happening in your network and, you know, either get a baseline and understand that none of your applications are going to break with EMET, or use that as a feed into some kind of a SIM to detect anomalous behavior. I think the intention was really more for the former than the latter. So I would definitely encourage you to take a look at EMET for your environment. I know one of the big criticisms of it is that it's not enterprise ready, but, you know, I think if you have people who are well skilled at programming in PowerShell and that sort of thing, I suspect you can write your own wrappers around it and get it there. It's a pretty valuable piece of technology. So, you know, I would definitely encourage you to see if you can make it work. All right, moving on. HostGator was hacked by one of its former employees, apparently before Eric Gunnar Geese, not really sure, from San Antonio, Texas. Apparently, before he left, he dropped a backdoor on 2,723 different HostGator servers. That is a busy boy. So apparently, the backdoor was relatively well disguised. And I would say it has some of the hallmarks of the rootkit type functionality. Definitely not a rootkit, but for instance, he dropped custom ps and netstat commands that would hide the process. And apparently he also had a SSH key that he took with him as he left, and the intention apparently was that it would allow him to get back in through the back door. Apparently he is now in jail and being held on a $20,000 bond, and no doubt will be made an example of by some eager prosecutor. This definitely highlights the problem of malicious insiders and the need to, based on the sensitivity and criticality of your environment, to monitor systems and monitor what the administrators and your employees are doing on those systems. And then periodically doing some kind of a baseline reassessment to check for things like modified binaries. And you know, those things may come as a result of a malicious insider, or may come as a result of somebody from the outside compromising it. But, you know, doing some kind of an independent reconciliation periodically would definitely be advisable in some of these more sensitive environments. Now, in the case of HostGator, I guess you could make a judgment call on whether that falls into the category of a sensitive situation or not. I certainly would expect people who host there may have the opinion that it is a sensitive environment. But, you know, the reality is web hosting now is a very commodity business. There's very little profit in it now. And so they run on scale and try to do things very cheaply. So this may just add a fairly untenable amount of overhead. But still, I think at some point, most industries have to take this introspection and figure out, you know, just given what we see happening out in the world, does it make sense to apply some kind of control and oversight over what our people are doing on systems? All right, so last week, apparently I had gone to the bar and came back and was pretty happy and offered to buy a copy of Richard Baitlick's new book that's coming out this summer. I think it's July, called The Practice of Network Security Monitoring, based on pulling names from whoever sends me suggestions to info@defensivesecurity.org. You know, I'm definitely going to honor that. I have a few suggestions. One of them, in fact, I thought was pretty good, from one of the followers of the podcast named Dan. And he recommended that I mention the books that I like. Now, clearly, there's a lot of books that I like, but if I stick to those that are security related, there's some that are maybe not as obvious as others. And I'll be honest, it's been a long time since I've read an actual security book. A lot of what I learned came from some more of the basic, and I say basic in kind of tongue-in-cheek, networking books. So the Richard Stevens TCP/IP set I found to be very interesting. I read those probably, I guess it's been 15 years ago or so. There was a data network and communications book. I'm going to have to try to find the name of that one. I spent a little bit of time trying to find it, and I know it's probably gone through about a dozen iterations since I read it. It was a huge book when I read it long, long ago. But, you know, I think it's one of those key things that you, as a security person, need to have in mind. You've got to have this, in, at least in my view, deep understanding of networks and systems. As far as what I've read recently, I'm about halfway through a couple of different really good security books. The first one is Network Forensics. tracking hackers through cyberspace. And the other one is Hacking Exposed 7. Hacking Exposed 7 is, I'd say, the jack of all trades, master of none. A lot of the stuff is very dated. As I'm reading this book now, you know, it's hugely long, although the network forensics book is pretty long too. What strikes me is that a lot of these things discussed in Hacking Exposed, you know, are 10, 12, 14 years old, and maybe older in some cases. But what's interesting is they use some of those examples to more identify the kinds of attacks, not necessarily talking about the specific attack itself, in an attempt to, again, explain the kind of the morphology of different attack vectors. Being in more or less a management leadership role, I'm also kind of drawn to the larger picture, maybe even more so than the details, although I will tell you the details of things are very interesting to me. I think from the ability to impact an organization's bottom line, having the ability to speak at a higher level in terms of security as managing risk, like an insurance policy, is very valuable. Otherwise, you're kind of relegated to being, you know, what I affectionately call a console jockey. So one of the books I really enjoyed, and I think I've talked about this before, is called How to Measure Anything. And it is not directly a security book, but it does talk a lot about security. And I think it has a tremendous amount of applicability to security. And the follow-on book to that, which I'm actually about, I'll say, two-thirds of the way through. And so, yes, I have a number of books that I'm currently reading. I maybe have attention deficit disorder, not really. But, you know, I kind of context switch from one book to another. This book is called The Failure of Risk Management. It's also by Douglas Hubbard. And as you might imagine, it's very much centered on risk management and does deal a lot with security and how most of the industry doesn't do risk assessments and risk analysis right. And so this is an important foundational concept for security departments to understand. I will tell you that I have recently being over the past 6 months, accumulated quite a few books on malware analysis and some other things. So as I get through some of those books, I'm going to give some reviews of them. But in the meantime, if you have any books that you'd like to recommend as being useful, you know, drop me a line, info@defensivesecurity.org, or hit me up on Twitter @defensivesec. Again, the offer stands. I'll give it another week. Send me feedback on Twitter or by email. I'll put your name in a hat. I'm going to give away an ebook. Not my ebook. Going to pay for it myself. I really believe in this stuff. Anyway, the morning is going to be coming pretty early, so I'm going to cut it short. As always, enjoy talking to everyone. I hope this is useful to you. Again, give me feedback. The website is www.defensivesecurity.org. You can find the show notes there. You can find the link to subscribe on iTunes. And also, I've posted a number of resources that I found helpful to me over the years. Anyway, have a peaceful week, and I will talk to you next week. Take care. Bye.